Tortured Poets Department conundrum. Is Lana Del Rey really back? And why can't we leave Sydney Sweeney alone?
I'm Maggie Zhao.
And I'm Jasmine Wallace.
And you're listening to Culture Club, where we chat about pop culture, current affairs, the internet, and our lives.
We acknowledge that the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people are the custodians of this land we are on today. We would like to pay our respects to elders past and present.
We would also like to celebrate the rich history of First Nations culture and storytelling that we are continually learning from. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
I am having some problems with my microphone this episode, so I'm so sorry if I don't sound as good as usual. We will work on it for next episode. Enjoy.
Jazz, I feel like you've had such a big week. I feel like a fan of yours. I love your Instagram photo dumps.
I'm trying to be better with like actually posting things and posting things on my grid. It has been a big week. It's just one of those times of the month and, you know, doing things after work, before work, at lunchtime, on your lunch break. So it's been really, really fun. We actually went to each other at one event, which was the Project Hutton Kick app and Tom Organic collab, which was like so many great brands working together on this, like, it was at in a studio in Collingwood, which is like a sauna, cold plunge and baths. Did you do the baths afterwards? Because we were in a different session. I was early because I had to go to work.
Yeah, you chose the 8 a.m. session. I picked the very reasonable 10:15 a.m. session. I did. I went sauna first and then went in the cold plunge for a very short amount of time before heading into the warm pool for a bit. Me, Kitch and Mel and Sam, we were just like yapping, like there was no tomorrow in the pool. A normal talking voice, I would say, but we got told off, reasonably so, because they were like, hey, sorry, there's a class on and the walls aren't soundproof, and we were kind of like, fuck capitalism and stuff like that. So I was like, oh, I felt really bad.
And that was like one of the fun things, but also we had book club on Sunday. We read Others Were Emeralds by Lang Leave. Average 3-star rating, but that was held at your house.
It was. I love hosting things, I think.
You think?
I think. Strong on the I think. But it was a really lovely time. We had our group of book club over for brunch. We've been recently going for like a Sunday brunch book club, and I feel like it works really well because it's chill. A few people, I mean, everyone rocked up late, and a few people rocked up worse for wear. A lot of people had big nights, which we love. But yeah, it was really fun. Interestingly enough, though, it wasn't just book club. It was kind of like a Taylor Swift club for a while.
Yeah. So we had to, a lot of the people in our book club are Taylor Swift fans, and we had to like stop ourselves from talking about the new album, The Tortured Poets Department, until we had finished the book chat. Because we're like, we'll just end up speaking about Taylor Swift the whole time. So we did our little book reviews, and then we got into what everyone thought of the album. And I know we spoke about it, but we need to hear it again. What do you think of the Tortured Poets Department, the rollout, the fact that a second album or, you know, double album was announced 2 hours after the first? How are you feeling like 48 hours later?
Oh, still exhausted, right? honestly, I think it was like a fine album, but I think what we'll get into, by the way, for listeners, we're going to go through our initial thoughts, things that we did like, didn't like, and also kind of the general criticism or like tone that this album has created. So just strap in with us. Look, I like a few songs for sure. I think one of our friends put it really well. So Grace McKinnon, who's an ABC journalist who is a massive Taylor Swift fan, she was talking about the fact that when the second album, you know, half dropped 2 hours after, she was just filled with like dread. And imagine your biggest fans feeling like that. And I kind of am still like hanging on to that feeling of like, that was a lot. We have been, I guess, given so much by Taylor in the last year, so many new songs, so many re-records, so many vault tracks, that it's like, oh my God, I can't keep my head above the water. There's so much to digest. So yeah, I mean, we'll get into the songs soon, but tell me you, how are you feeling now?
Yeah, I was the same. So yeah, 2 o'clock when it came out, I heard the first two songs and I was actually disappointed at first. I was like, this is really boring. The Tortured Poets Department lyrics, I still stand by that. I really cringe. Like the actual song, the title track. But yeah, a few standouts for me. So I was happy with it. It did sound like a baby of Midnights and Folklore, which I really enjoyed that sound, like overall. And then I was just about to finish the second listen through of the first part and I get a text from Grace McKinnon, and she was like, oh my God, there's more. And I replied like, what are you talking about? She's like, double album, like all caps. And I was just like, holy shit. So I started listening to that, but like obviously straight away, but it just started to all blur into like one big long sound of Taylor's voice. Cause I was just listening while I was like, while I was like finding the tweets for carousels and things like that. There were less standouts on the second album for me because I still feel like I haven't properly listened through, like sitting down. Since that Friday afternoon, I haven't, again, had like another deep, deep listen. But I do have some standouts and some faves that I keep going back to over listening to like the second, like the slower songs from the second album or second part of the album. It's the same album, isn't it?
Do tell.
My personal faves at the moment on the, you know, 48 hours later are So Long London, Who's Afraid of Little Old Me, and probably Fortnite at the moment, which is funny because, like I said, when I first heard it, I was like, oh God, like I don't like this at all. But it really has grown on me and now it's definitely one of my faves. So they are my top three if I had to choose. I also love like Florida and The Alchemy and Claribo and like that kind of vibe. What about you?
Yeah, I feel like this is an album of growers. So the more I listen, the more I like it. But my top four currently, I mean, there's a new one that's kind of weaseling its way into it. But I would say I Can Do It With a Broken Heart. I find that very fun. So Long London is definitely a standout for me as well. And I also do like The Bolter and My Boy Only Breaks His Favorite Toys. After our conversation with Book Club, like we were so varied. A lot of the time, yeah, we're like so on the same page, but we had such differing favorite and like least favorite songs. There's been such a mixed reaction. And I feel like I digested this album like away from the internet. I only listened to it on Saturday and I wasn't really reading much or seeing the memes and stuff. So it was also a different experience, I guess, just like listening to it without the background noise, or I guess the lore, which makes up so much of it.
As an album, you know, we've got our favorite songs, but like how do you feel about Taylor Swift maybe oversaturation and the kind of chat that was surrounding this album in particular?
Again, not to borrow from our friend Grace, but I will. She was talking about the fact that, you know, Midnights didn't come out that long ago. Taylor could have sat with this album a bit more. Another one of our friends, Kelly, who is a massive fan, she said like, oh, in a way, like, let's do homework. The big challenge would be like, what 10 to 12 songs would you actually pick for this album? I feel like that would have been way more effective. I just think it was an overload and it was really quite overwhelming to receive like 31 new songs. And a lot of them, as you said, they felt quite homogenous.
Yeah, I've seen some chat about Taylor has such a strong fan base that to them, more songs is better than less and they will love it. Like, you know, like us, I say we are people I'm speaking about right now, is like we're just happy to hear more songs and artistry and her lyrics and to like decode them rather than like another artist would do that album for maybe 6 months more and like go over and like the whole point of an album. Otherwise, everyone would release 31 song albums. The whole point is that you're editing it and curating it to be a specific sound or to tell a specific story. Mm. That's my thoughts. I don't want to complain because I'm really happy to receive more Taylor music, but I also do understand the criticism. And I think we do have to criticize and like we do need to hold space. That's probably a bit too serious, but we do need to listen to people's reviews because she's not immune to criticism. And I think like some of the fandom stuff, like is it Anthony from Queer Eye commented on a New York Times Instagram post that was like the Tortured Poet, basically saying like the Tortured Poets Department is a good album. It could have done with an editor.
Yeah.
And Anthony is like, oh no, what are you doing? And it's like, these are cultural commentators. Like this is their whole job is to be unbiased and to like review an album or like review a moment in the culture. And people being like, no, what are you doing? Like, you can't do this. It's Taylor. Oh my God. Like, I think that's setting a precedent that's actually dangerous. I know we're talking about music and art and culture here, but like that can bleed into other types of media literacy. And that I think is dangerous.
Yeah.
So I just think we need to like check ourselves as a fandom on that.
Even when you're like, it's their job to be unbiased in this regard, I would argue it's like the opposite, like to be biased and to be okay having a point of view on Taylor and stating an opinion. It was interesting though, I don't know about you, but my like Twitter feed was full of a lot of commentary and critique of Taylor. I don't necessarily read music reviews. Like I'm not a really big like critic review person. I think I should be more. That was one of my like pseudo New Year's resolution. I wanted to like read more of that. But I did read two pieces that were really great. The first one I want to talk about is called The Tortured Poets Department Review, A Rare Misstep. And that was by Laura Malloy for NME. And in it, the writer makes some really good points. I think one point that they made that I agree with was that this was, quote, an album mostly devoid of any noticeably stylistic shift or evolution. Would you agree with that, Chaz?
I do agree that she might be exploring the same genre she's touched on previously. Like there are some songs that are a bit more folklore-y. There's some like country western inspired. Obviously, I know she started as a country artist, but that kind of like dark western Texas vibe. There's a bit of that, but I agree that it doesn't like go to any new places for her as an artist.
Yeah. I mean, I like this line that Laura said as well. It mostly descends into a monochromatic palette existing in the same Jack Antonoff branded synth pop as Midnight, yet struggling to capture any of its brightness. I think there's been a lot of criticism leveled at Jack Antonoff this week, Mrs. Synth Lover, which has been very interesting to watch as well.
Yes, definitely. I feel like even some of her fans are like, Jack Antonoff, get out of the studio. Because isn't it true that like the two producers, Aaron Dessner and then Jack Antonoff, they did kind of like half the album each, and that's why it's like a double album and why they sound a bit different. There's a lot less synth in the second half.
Yes, yes, yes. Again, we're not music experts, so I am really leaning on like, I can hear the synths. But yeah, Jack was mainly responsible for the first half and Aaron for the second half.
I also found this part of the piece interesting, and the writer says, it's why the lyrical themes of victimhood that once aided her image come off as increasingly jarring today. On But Daddy, I Love Him, she positions herself at the mercy of too high a horse from her naysayers, but it grates against a landscape that often declares her exempt from criticism. And this is also what we were talking about at book club yesterday about Thank You, Amy, which is obviously like a Kim diss track. Even our friend Ali Daisy King, who is one of the most staunch Taylor Swift fans I know personally, even she was like, what are you doing, girl? Like this had been put to bed kind of thing. Why are you basically making a diss track about Kim? There's certain songs that I think could have been left in the vault, so to speak. And she has said, Taylor has said that this is like one of her most personal albums. And that's definitely true in some of the lyricism. But sometimes, and she actually said at the Taylor Swift concert we were at in Melbourne in February that she like needed to write this album to like get it all out. Obviously, she's been through a lot of heartbreak in the last year or so. But, you know, there's a difference, I think, between like writing for catharsis, which I think was definitely happening on Thank You, Amy and a few other songs. And then like so blatantly putting that out into the world. It's like you're reading her diary, and sometimes I guess that means that you can cringe at it. Like, yeah, you would cringe reading someone else's diary, I think.
Yep, completely. And I think the through line in the album of her kind of playing the victim, or even the, like, who's afraid of little old me? I, every time I hear that said, I like seize up with cringe, because I'm like, little old who? Like, not you. And I get it as well, but I do think it is grating for the audience, right? Who's built her up to be a millionaire, who's sold out her stadium tours. It does remind me, billionaire, don't forget the B, oops. I would say that my standout piece of writing that I read about Taylor was this piece titled Premature Evaluation, Taylor Swift, The Tortured Poets Department. This was written for Stereogum by Tom Brehan. Never heard of this publication. It's a music one. Did you see this going around?
I didn't, no.
I want you to read some of it out. I bloody love it. Do you want to give the audience a taste?
Taylor Swift was writing bangers before she was old enough to drive a car. Through every stage of her career, she's made bangers. More than anything else, those bangers are the reason why people care about Swift's personal life. Whenever she's encountered a transcendent moment of joy, heartbreak, anger, fear, confusion, exhilaration, or anything else, her response has been to write a banger about it. But now, the law has come to swallow the music. With some exceptions, the songs on the tour are simply not strong enough to support the weight of all that fucking storyline. It's starting to feel like the law is all we have. It's not enough.
What do you think?
I think this is a pretty scathing review. Do you think people are going to be happy about this?
No. Okay. See, I would like to say that in the piece, the writer is very quite generous to the music as well, and definitely like pulls out the highlights of particular songs and is quite generous, I would like to say. I know the quotes that we might pull out aren't potentially, but I really like how Tom, this writer, talks about, I guess, all the discourse or the backstory that is potentially clouding this album. So late in the piece, I'll just read out a bit more because it links to what you just read out as well. He writes, "But there I go again, talking about the narrative rather than the music. The sheer voluminous weight of all that fucking lore keeps forcing its way in there because the music can't push through the noise that surrounds it. It's frustrating. Taylor Swift is singing about rage and lust and passion over music that evokes none of those things. It's an album that you can play pretty loud at night without worrying about waking up anyone else in the house. At least judging by early online reaction, a lot of people have been waiting for a chance to turn on Taylor Swift. A sizable portion of the public is not rooting for the anti-hero. This was probably inevitable. Swift is as overexposed as a celebrity can possibly be today. She's broken every record and won every award. She's not an underdog. She's an overdog. She's the overdog. If anything, the Tortured Poets Department steers into the inevitable backlash."
I do agree with that point that a lot of people have been waiting for this moment since like Folklore Evermore to turn on Taylor Swift again. I feel like people have been a bit more brazen again with their like criticism of Taylor Swift and her fans, and especially of them being cringe. And I don't know, I think two things can be true at once. Just because we're critiquing her art doesn't mean that we're still not her fans. And it is interesting as well that she hasn't done any interviews with journalists for this album. I don't think she ever really does.
But she rarely does because she doesn't need to, yeah. I think what I'm left with after our conversation is the fact that, like, I love Taylor Swift's music. I think the music can usually speak for itself. I am honestly not interested in Easter eggs or like past album links.
No, neither.
And even like who the songs are about. I just want the music, right? So I wish all these like extra vinyl releases and like Spotify stamped parchment paper and all that kind of buzz could just like dissipate a bit more and just like let her focus on the art, the music. Like, I wish she could do that. Like, I wish she chose that.
I agree. I find the Easter eggs so tiring. Even just, like, I wasn't even clicking into articles that were, like, these are the Easter eggs from, like, the teaser album trailer, like, anything. I was, like, I just don't have brain space to like go through with a freaking magnifying glass and be like, oh, that means that this type of song is going to be in this album. Like, I was really excited for the release. I did count down to 2 p.m. Like, I was very excited. I was like live texting people who, mm-hmm. you know, were listening at the same time. But yeah, sometimes I'm like, I agree with you. Like, sometimes we should just let the music speak for itself.
In more music news, Coachella was back.
Yes, the music festival was back last week. Well, it was 2 weekends. And this year actually looked really fun. I feel like it's the first year that's had its kind of magic back. And there are a few reasons for that.
Tell me. I don't know how I feel about it from what I've seen. Again, I haven't been that up to date with it, but why was like the magic back for you guys?
Well, I think the artists were really good who they chose. They were very on the pulse. They didn't have Frank Ocean, you know, late to his set and not performing and everyone live streaming it. There were also less influences and like less influencer events. And I think people are getting sick of like those types of influencer trips and that type of influencer exposure. People would rather see everyday people who've like saved up their money to buy a ticket and who are wearing clothes they own, rather than this like big bejeweled like influencer bikini thing and going to like these events with certain brands. There seemed to be less of that this year.
It's like, oh, it's a more laid back, less Instagram heavy festival. But it was so funny because I think some of the celeb outfits were like the ugliest things I've ever seen, and go them, like it is their right. It was a TikTok user, their name's Erin at Worst Girlfriend, who did an incredible kind of like scathing but very funny like breakdown of people's outfits. They for instance described some celebs as, quote, how rich people dress their dogs or untrustworthy real estate agents. I just keep thinking about Barry Keoghan, who I love, but what was that outfit?
He was just being number one fanboy for Sabrina Carpenter, and who could blame him? There was one bit of internet chatter that depressed me to no end, and that was the conversations around Lana Del Rey's weight. So Lana Del Rey was performing. She rode in on the back of a motorcycle with a bikey on it. She was glowing. She looked beautiful. She performed all of her biggest hits. It was a really, really full set. But there were so many tweets about people being like, oh my God, we're so back, or like Lana Del Rey is back. And it's like, she hasn't gone anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
She had previously put on weight. Now she's lost it. People were saying it could be from Ozempic. We don't know that. But regardless of how she lost the weight, I think the fact that people were commenting on it in the first place and saying like, oh, we're so back because she looks like her 25-year-old self when she's like in her mid-30s is really, mm-hmm. really depressing actually.
Yeah, a tweet that was quoted in a few articles. A fan, mind you, quote tweeting some of like the photos with the caption, the Ozempic worked, we won. That is sickening to hear that.
I saw another tweet that was a good tweet that was like, if I was Lana Del Rey, I would, what was it, like throw a hamburger at these people and like tell them to fuck off or something like that. There was an article that you read about this in High Snobiety. It's titled, Is Lana Del Rey Back or Has Her Body Just Changed? And it's by Alexandra Pauly.
So Alexandra writes, it's not that Lana Del Rey is back. It's that Lana Del Rey's body is back to meeting culture's thin ideal. But did Del Rey ever really leave? Over the course of her decade plus long career, her style hasn't wavered sartorially nor musically. She hasn't undergone a rebrand or entered a new era, at least to the extent that her fellow pop stars have. She never disappeared. We just didn't want to look when her body was larger.
Del Rey's fans may not realize what they're insinuating when they praise her new look, her glow up, and her return, whatever they want to call it. I'd like to think that the majority of these onlookers don't mean any harm. That said, when the only thing that has changed over the years is Del Rey's weight, it's worth digging deeper. I just feel so angry about, I know it's like, I know she's a celebrity and she's probably fine. She hopefully hasn't seen this, but as someone whose weight fluctuates a lot, like even week to week, I know that when you are slimmer, you get treated differently, whether it's like subconscious for some people. And this is me saying this with quite straight size privilege. I've fluctuated between like a 10 to a 14 in my adulthood. And I understand that's still not even considered plus size. It's not plus size. So this is speaking from my experience. But I know that like when I've lost weight in the past, people have been like, oh my God, you look so good. You're glowing. Like, and I understand it could be, maybe I am eating better. Maybe I am drinking more water. My skin's clearer and it is glowing more. But like, it's because I've lost body fat. That's the difference. And I know I get treated differently when I have done. But then when I put it back on, it's like, oh no, like you're still beautiful. And that's fine with me. Like I know that I can be quite body neutral, but I don't know. It just really upsets me, this story, because we think we're so freaking body positive in the 2020s and weight doesn't matter and how you look doesn't matter, but it fucking still does. Like, I don't know if that's ever going to go away, that cultural thing of like skinny being more culturally like aspirational and you being considered worth more when you take up less space. I don't know if that's like, I thought, I don't know, I'm getting really deep here, but I felt so optimistic when I was like early 20s, when we had all the conversations around like probably 2016 to 2022, like those kind of conversations around like curvy models and body positivity and things like that. But now that we're going back the other way, it's just like exhausting.
Yeah. And like, honestly, after conversations like what we just saw Lana go through, like your point is made tenfold in front of you. It's so feral. And I do think because of the rise of casual use of Ozempic and like the very flippant way we speak about it, it's become even more normalized. And like, that is so dystopian. Mm. I just, you know, this, we're talking about like diabetes medication that people actually need, that is just being abused so that the like elite can lose weight. And it's just like a terrible, terrible reality that we live in.
Yeah. Lana Del Rey's conversation also relates to some criticism that has been hurled at Sydney Sweeney. Why is Sydney Sweeney's body such a political playground? That also pisses me off to no end. There's never-ending discourse about Sydney's breasts and her beauty. She's a very beautiful woman. So there was an article from Slate titled They're Not That Big to one in Canada's National Post, which asked if they signaled the death of woke. Again, I'm very passionate about this topic, being a G-cup woman. And just can't catch a break. But she is also playing into it a little bit. She did, you know, there's the criticism of like, well, if she doesn't want to be seen as like, you know, I don't know, a vixen or whatever people are calling her, why did she play like a Hooters waitress on her SNL skit? But I don't know, maybe that's her like taking back the narrative. It's like, oh, you want to like put me into these roles, or, you know, I'm taking these roles, or you want to like have these fantasies about my body, I'll give you one kind of vibe. I don't know if that's what she was trying to achieve with that SNL skit.
Yeah, I think she was. Like, I think in the same way where she was making fun of her, like the rumors around her and Glenn Powell, like I think she's trying to like be like, oh yeah, I know what you think of me. Like, I'm not going to step, like I'm not afraid of that. But on the flip side, like the new movie that she stars in, Immaculate, the horror mystery film, I think she also, in a different way, like subverts the stereotypes that have been put on her. Like in a few scenes, she apparently like appears really grotesque and like not the beauty standard by far.
Ooh.
I just, Yeah, I don't know if I'll watch it. I mean, obviously I would love to, but I'm not a horror girl, so.
No, I'm too scared. Yeah, so more recently, Sydney actually clapped back at a Hollywood producer who criticized her looks and her acting ability and was a fellow woman, which pisses me off. Carol Baum, who is known for her work on Father of the Bride and Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Weird. Two things that I've watched recently. Funny. From the 90s. She said, Janet Maslin, a film critic for the New York Times. She said, there's an actress who everybody loves now, Sydney Sweeney. I don't get Sydney Sweeney. I was watching on the plane Sydney Sweeney's movie, which was Anyone But You, because I wanted to watch it. I wanted to know who she is and why everybody was talking about her. I said to my class, explain this girl to me. She's not pretty. She can't act. Why is she so hot? And that was referencing the class that she teaches at the USC School of Cinematic Arts.
Oh, God. Again, wow, we've had some really annoying news stories this week. And I think this one, Miss Carol, just really proves that like the old guard and like the old way of thinking is still so prevalent. Like I think a lot of women who, again, I can imagine she's had to rough it in the industry. She's had to tough it out. It's been really probably hard to get where she has been growing up. But it's like, oh, every other woman has to suffer now because you suffered. That is not a good mentality to have.
I'm sad that a woman in the position to share her expertise and experience chooses instead to attack another woman. If that's what she's learned in her decades in the industry and feels is appropriate to teach her students, that's shameful. To unjustly disparage a fellow female producer speaks volumes about Miss Baum's character.
Ooh. They really popped off with that. I think like the inclusion of the word, like how shameful.
And like, it's one thing having an opinion like that and saying it to your friends, but it's in the freaking New York Times and like singling someone out. It's giving Jennifer Lopez. Did you see that Jennifer Lopez interview that kind of came up again? It's from like 1997. And in it, the journalist is like asking her opinion on all these other female actresses and stars of the time. And she's like dissing every single one of them in an article. It's like, babes, do you know this is on the record? Like, this is going to be published.
Yeah.
I don't know. Do you think you're just like chit-chatting with your friends over coffee? No.
Yeah. It was like Gwyneth Paltrow, Winona Ryder. Just, oh God. It was rough. I think it was like quite early on J-Lo's career, but I was like, ooh, I love that it's being dug up right now. Whatever's on the record stays on the record. It's time for recommendations. Every week we bring you something that we've either enjoyed reading, watching, or listening to. Jazz, what is yours for us?
Today I'm recommending the movie Challengers. And it stars Zendaya, Mike Face, and Josh O'Connor. And it's by Luca Guadagnino, who did Call Me By Your Name. This is a big shift for this director. We actually went and saw it at the movies last week. I took you along. And I think we had mixed, like, different reviews.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed it. Like, if someone was like, I'm going to see Challengers, you want to come? I'd go back to see it at the movies as well. I think it's one you should definitely see at the cinema if you can, because of, like, the film techniques they use are so interesting. There's a scene where it's, like, the point of view is you're literally the tennis ball. There's one point of view where the camera's panning as if you're looking through the character's eyes. There's a scene where, actually, I won't, that's probably a bit too much of a spoiler, but I'll go through the plot for people who haven't heard of it. So Tashi is a champion tennis player when she's 18. She then becomes a coach. Okay, so it's a kind of hard to explain. So it's a love triangle and it jumps through time. That's why I'm getting confused. Like, it jumps through time. So it's like they're 18, then Tashi is married to one of these two men, and I guess the themes are about like competition, growing up in general, love, platonic love and romantic love, and power and money. A lot of the movie takes place over the course of a tennis game, and I thought that was also so interesting as well, the way it was like match one is the present day and then it goes back in time to like tell more of their story as a thruple or whatever. It tells more of their backstory, and then it goes to like match two. And then, so you can see them present day as like early 30-year-olds, goes backwards. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. I've actually been listening to the soundtrack when I've been really needing to lock in at work.
Nice. And
it really works. So also recommend the soundtrack. It's a really, like, definitely a summer movie. It's quite sexy and sweaty. There's less actual sex than I thought. From the trailer, I thought it was going to be a bit more horny than it was. I think they kind of played on that to get people in.
They did.
But it still definitely has a lot of tension. And, yeah, it's really entertaining. So I would recommend everyone go watch it.
Hell yeah. I found it really compelling in the way that they portray like people's desires and motives. I feel like they did a really good job of how complicated that can be and how intertwined it is with a lot of things like power, as you mentioned, and other things. So yeah, love it. Love that you kept it spoiler free as well.
Yeah, I was trying so hard. Oh, sorry. Everyone's like, wait, I don't know what this movie is still about. It's quite confusing. So yeah, just go watch it. And Mags, what have you been loving, watching, reading, or listening to this week?
Again, I've been so checked out of like media and content, but the book I am recommending, I'm breaking my rule. I'm not yet finished, but I'm almost there. Like I've literally got maybe like 50 pages left of like a 350 page book. So I'm almost there. It is a novel called Allow Me to Introduce Myself, and it is by Onyi Nwabinelli. This book is so up Culture Club's alley. We have been speaking so much about the plight of like child influencers and the toll that it brings on like family vloggers and stuff like that. And this is a fiction novel that has that as its foundation. So a bit more about its blurb. It follows a woman in her 20s, Anuri, and her life was actually monetized and chronicled by her influencer stepmother. We see her now kind of estranged from her family, and now she's like somewhat broken free from that. However, she's got a young half-sister who's now in the same position. So she kind of tries to step in and break that cycle of abuse. It's really, really well written. I would say it sits in the contemporary fiction realism realm. The characters are really nicely like fleshed out. The world, it feels so real. You can picture this happening, and it centers on Black characters. The author herself is Nigerian British May, though. And if people are a fan of books like Brie Lee's The Work, I would say that this sits in a similar realm.
Sounds so good. Is that the one I saw on your dining table yesterday?
Yes. It is. The sound copy I have is like really big, like allow me to introduce myself
in
the
bright
colors.
Yeah.
But yeah, really loving that one.
Amazing. Well, I'll borrow off you when you're done.
100%.
Thank you for listening.
Yes, thank you so much for listening today. We also wanted to give a special shout out to Lauren Clare, who left us a really lovely Apple review. Thank you so much for the love. It really brightened our days. And if anyone else wants to leave us a review, you know where to do it.
Otherwise, we will chat with you online.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.